Welcome to Washington Today for Friday, February 4th, 2022. I'm Nkoyo Iyamba. Former Vice President Mike Pence says former President Donald Trump is wrong and that he had, quote, no right to overturn the election. He spoke at the Federalist Society this afternoon. We'll hear more of what he had to say in just a moment. Republican Party officials voted to punish Republican Representatives Liz Cheney of Wyoming and Adam Kinzinger of Illinois for their work on the House committee investigating the January 6th insurrection and advanced a rule change that would prohibit candidates from participating in debates organized by the Commission on Presidential Debates. The U.S. economy created nearly 500,000 jobs last month. That's according to the Labor Department, beating economists' expectations and suggesting the Omicron coronavirus variant did not cause as much damage to the labor market as anticipated. We'll hear more from Barron's reporter Megan Casella in just a moment. New cases of COVID-19 in the U.S. are falling in 49 of 50 states as Omicron rapidly loosens its grip. And even as the nation's death toll closes in on another bleak round number, 900,000 people. Now, according to data posted by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the number of lives lost to the pandemic in the U.S. stood at over 897,000, with deaths running at an average of more than 2,400 a day. That's back up to where they were last winter when the vaccine drive was still getting started. Now, the curve is trending downward in every state but Maine. We begin in Florida, where late this afternoon, former Vice President Mike Pence said that former President Donald Trump was wrong, saying, quote, I had no right to overturn the election. Here's what he had to say late this afternoon at the Federalist Society.
But there are those in our party who believe that as the presiding officer over the joint session of Congress, that I possess unilateral authority to reject Electoral College votes. And I heard this week that President Trump said I had the right to overturn the election. But President Trump is wrong. I had no right to overturn the election. The presidency belongs to the American people and the American people alone. And frankly, there is no idea more un-American than the notion that any one person could choose the American president. Under the Constitution, I had no right to change the outcome of our election.
Former Vice President Mike Pence speaking at the Federalist Society in Florida. We head now to the White House State Dining Room, where President Joe Biden said, quote, America is back to work. That's as he delivered remarks on the January 2022 jobs report.
I'm pleased to report this morning, but many of you already know, that America's job machine is going stronger than ever, fueling a strong recovery and opportunity for hardworking women and men all across this great country. America is back to work. Today, we've learned that in January, our economy created 467,000 jobs. But that's not all. We learned that job growth in November and December over last year was revised up by more than 700,000 jobs. On top of that, 400,000 jobs previously, on top of the 400,000 that were previously reported. This morning's report caps off my first year as president. And over that period, our economy created 6.6 million jobs. 6.6 million jobs. You can't remember another year when so many people went to work in this country. There's a reason. It never happened. Take a look at the chart. You can look at the last, all the way back to President Reagan. Look how many jobs we created in an average per month. This is, it's never happened before. And look, history's been made here. But it comes alongside the largest drop in unemployment rate in a single year on record, the largest reduction in childhood poverty ever recorded in a single year, and the strongest economic growth this country has seen in nearly 40 years.
The U.S. added 467,000 jobs in January. Omicron's impact was less than feared. That's the headline at Barron's.com by economics and policy reporter Megan Casella. What does this new data tell us?
It shows us that where we really expected a slowdown over the past month because of the Omicron variant in terms of the labor market, it didn't show up. The labor market is quite strong. And we actually saw significant revisions that shows us the labor market has been hot for a while. We saw much stronger job growth in both November and December than we had previously thought. And it shows us that the economy is really resilient and that it's really been shaking off Omicron as the variant has surged.
And what's contributing to the growth?
It's really across the board. The leisure and hospitality industries pretty surprisingly led the way in terms of job growth in January. It shows that restaurants and bars continued to add employees despite the number of people who called out sick, despite the number who had to close down temporarily because of staff outbreaks and that sort of thing. And another, I think, less considered factor is that industries really weren't laying off workers in January. It looks like while generally with seasonality, people tend to shed workers, businesses tend to shed workers after the holidays, I don't think we saw as much of that, in part because of the labor shortage. People were really hanging on to the workers that they had.
And so what does the public need to know about the significance of these numbers?
I think what the report shows us is that the economy really is doing quite well. The labor market is really strong. We're really close to what economists and what the Federal Reserve call full employment. A lot of people think we're already there. We're seeing that wages are rising fairly quickly, although in most industries they are being outpaced by inflation, but they are rising significantly. Industries are hanging on to their workers. Businesses are still adding jobs and looking to hire more. And so we're in a pretty good place. What that tells us is, one, you know, looking back over the past year, because of those revisions that I mentioned, job growth was really a lot steadier than we initially thought. There wasn't the huge surge in the summer that we'd initially thought was there. There wasn't the big slowdown in the winter that we initially thought was there. It was very steady over the year. And it shows us that there really is this resilience. Even in the face of the Omicron variant and the Delta variant before that, the economy is hanging on. The other thing that it really signals for us is that we could see some shifts moving forward with monetary policy. This sort of bolsters the case that the Federal Reserve is on track to raise interest rates as soon as next month. There's very little reason now, especially as we're seeing labor force participation rise and other strong signals like that, there's very little reason for the Federal Reserve not to do so, given the high inflationary environment that we're in.
Put this in perspective for Joe and Jane Public. What do they need to understand in terms of their financial well-being?
It shows that we're in a really good place. If you're looking for a job, keep looking. You should get one. If you are in a position to ask for more money, it could be a good time to do that, given how quickly we're seeing wages rise. And we know that employers are willing to pay more for workers because they need them right now, and to pay more to hang on to the ones that they have. As far as the Federal Reserve's moves, it means that borrowing costs could go up. You know, that could make interest rates higher for credit card debt, for buying a house, loans, that sort of thing. But it also, hopefully, the goal is that it could start to temper inflation later this year. So, you know, we're going to continue to see prices rise at the grocery store, at the gas pump, almost certainly for the next several months. But the Federal Reserve is on track to, you know, do what it can to try to rein that in. Jobs are still strong. It's a good time to look for a job, a good time to ask for more money. And, you know, we'll see where the inflationary environment goes from here.
Well, and there's that discrepancy. You have higher prices at the grocery store, at the pump, yet the economy is doing well. And so for, again, Joe and Jane Public, they hear this news and they're thinking, well, how is this actually helping me?
That's where it gets tricky. You know, this difference between how strong the fundamental economy looks based on the data that we get versus the perception of the economy. And perception certainly matters here, because if it doesn't feel like the economy is working for you, then people aren't going to think that the economy is doing well, and they're not going to give, you know, this administration, for example, any credit for having a strong economy. So there is a bit of a divide there. As long as prices keep rising, I think that it's going to feel like this economy isn't working for everyone. Even within the jobs report, which I said was positive for this month and a few months prior to this as well, there's still discrepancies there. Not all workers, not all races, not all, you know, women versus men, not everyone's doing as well as the top line number will suggest. So there's definitely still discrepancies there as well. And so it shows that, you know, there's, despite the progress that has been made, despite how strong the recovery has been, particularly in comparison to the recovery from the Great Recession, there's still a ways to go. And we can't lose sight of the fact that we are in this very high inflationary environment that's painful for everyone, and particularly the lowest income consumers. We're going to need to see wages rise faster than they are currently in order to keep up and in order for people to feel like they can handle these higher prices that they're seeing every day.
And so would we be looking at these same numbers regardless of what kind of administration that we have in the White House?
I mean, it's always true that the party in power either gets the credit or the blame for whatever's going on, regardless of what they had to do with it. Supporters of this administration say that the recovery is only as strong as it is because of the policies that they passed last year. Detractors say that, you know, those same policies are to blame for inflation and we need to vote them out because otherwise inflation, you know, would be handled. We wouldn't see such high gas prices if President Joe Biden had never been elected. I mean, of course, some of this would have happened regardless, but the party in power always takes both the credit and the blame.
The U.S. adding 467,000 jobs in January. Find that headline at Barron's.com by economics and policy reporter Megan Casella. Thank you so much for helping us understand this.
Thanks so much for having me.
Top Democrats and Republicans laid out where they are in terms of a deal that could fund the federal government for the remainder of the fiscal year. They're hoping to avert a shutdown while potentially pumping new spending into health care, education, science, and defense. Since President Biden took office, the U.S. government has operated under short-term measures that sustain key federal agencies and programs largely at their existing spending levels. The stopgaps have kept the government running, but they have also delayed Democrats from delivering on some of the White House's top priorities, from expanding affordable housing to confronting climate change. Here's South Carolina Congressman James Clyburn speaking today for Majority Leader Steny Hoyer of Maryland, who was out with COVID-19.
The House will consider H.R. 4445, the Ending Forced Arbitration of Sexual Assault and Sexual Harassment Act, introduced by Representative Sherry Bustos, which would end forced arbitration in cases relating to sexual assault and harassment, providing survivors with legal recourse to seek justice in court against their assailants. The House will also consider H.R. 3485, the Global Respect Act, introduced by Representative David Cicilline, which furthers our nation's commitment to LGBTQ rights around the world by sanctioning foreign individuals found to be complicit in violating the human rights of LGBTQ people. Additionally, the House will consider Carolyn Maloney's H.R. 3076, the Postal Service Reform Act. This bipartisan bill would strengthen the financial position of the United States Postal Service and ensure it continues to successfully carry out its mandate to deliver mail to every household and business in the country. Lastly, the House stands ready to act on the Build Back Better Act, as well as the Freedom to Vote, John R. Luce Act, should the Senate amend them. And, of course, we will act on appropriations, hopefully on an omnibus bill, but we will not allow the government to shut down.
House Majority Whip, South Carolina Democrat Representative James Clyburn, earlier on the House floor. Twice in recent months, the appropriations process has nearly brought federal agencies to a screeching halt, threatening to shut down the government and hamstring the country's response to the pandemic. Here's Minority Whip Steve Scalise, Republican of Louisiana, earlier on the House floor.
And thank the gentleman. As it relates to the funding of government, February 18th is the current date of expiration for government funding. The gentleman knows we're not scheduled to be in that week, so next week would be the last week that the House is scheduled to be in session prior to that date. We haven't seen any agreement on a broader long-term package. There has been some talk we've been hearing there may be a short-term CR brought forward next week. Does the gentleman know if there is any anticipation of a continuing resolution to be brought forward next week? And if so, is there a length of time that's being anticipated if that legislation were to come forward next week? And I'd yield.
If the gentleman yields back, Yes, we've heard all of those discussions, and we are hopeful that something will come forward next week in the form of an omnibus. But if not, we'll respond appropriately when we get to that point.
All right, so we'll determine whether or not that that happens. If there is a date that the gentleman's aware of, if there would be a short term, we'd be interested in seeing that.
I'm not aware of a date, but I would hope that if we do not get an omnibus, there will be a short-term SCR, because the gentleman knows that getting the omnibus is very, very important to our constituents back home, to so that people can plan their lives sufficiently. And he and I both are very concerned about the effectiveness of our representation of our constituents.
House Minority Whip Steve Scalise speaking with House Majority Whip James Clyburn. Congress narrowly avoided a shutdown in early December when legislators passed a stopgap funding bill to extend the current budget until February. You're listening to Washington Today. Welcome back to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Nkoyo Iyamba with more headlines. Earlier today, International Olympic Committee President Thomas Bach urged world leaders to, quote, give peace a chance at the outset of the Winter Games in Beijing, an apparent nod to the ongoing security crisis along Ukraine's borders and Western criticism of China's human rights abuses. He continued, quote, in this Olympic spirit of peace, I appeal to all political authorities across the world, observe your commitment to this Olympic truth. Give peace a chance. The Olympics begin tonight, and they will run for 19 days of competition across 15 sports. The European Union and the United States have agreed to resume trade in oysters, clams, mussels, and scallops starting at the end of February. This is settling a 10-year trade dispute. Trade in live mollusks between the EU and the U.S. had stopped in 2011 due to divide in regulatory standards. Under the deal announced Friday, two EU member countries, Spain and the Netherlands, will be allowed to export mollusks to the U.S., while two American states, Massachusetts and Washington, can now trade to the EU. This weekend, Queen Elizabeth II will mark Accession Day on February 6, the 70th anniversary of her time on the throne. At 95 years old, she is the longest-serving monarch in British history. The official Platinum Jubilee celebrations will take place in the UK in June. And now on Capitol Hill. The House passed legislation on Friday aimed at bolstering domestic supply chains and scientific research to make the U.S. more competitive with nations like China. Lawmakers passed the bill largely along party lines, 222 to 210, with one Republican voting for it and one Democrat voting no. Representative Adam Kinzinger, Republican of Illinois, who backed the bill, authored numerous provisions related to boosting supply chains, while Representative Stephanie Murphy, Democrat of Florida, voted no. And she said in a statement, quote, she objected to, quote, problematic, poorly vetted provisions related to trade. Here's Richard Neal, Democrat of Massachusetts. He's the chairman of the Ways and Means on why the Competes Bill is good.
This is a very pivotal moment. As earlier described, one of the challenges that America has is that we still have the edge in terms of innovation and creativity in the world. The difficulty is that because you can do production just about anywhere now, they replicate our innovation with lower wages. So keeping our competitive posture is essential. The Competes Act that you're witnessing today has done precisely that. It will bolster the economy, it will reinforce technological leadership, and we can't be content with complacency. Still, nothing comes close to what our universities and colleges provide. The trade provisions and the Ways and Means Committee perspective, they largely are very important because of the fact that we supercharge America's opportunities through GSP, once again. We strengthen anti-dumping competition, countervailing duties laws to protect America from unfair Chinese competition. We also understand that in terms of sovereign capitalism, they can move faster, but they still need innovation and creativity, which overwhelmingly belongs to us. I still want to acknowledge as well Earl Blumenauer. He did a great job as the Trade Subcommittee Chairman on this. The General System of Preferences and Miscellaneous Tariff Bill legislation that's included is essential. And I want to say this because this is perhaps the most important thing that the Ways and Means Committee contributed. Trade adjustment assistance, because of the dislocations that from time to time create hollowed out parts of the American economy for people through no practices of their own are punished. And it's because of the unfair trade practices that frequently take place.
Massachusetts Democrat Richard Neal. Meanwhile, West Virginia Representative Carol Miller is against the bill.
Madam Speaker, President Biden's trade moratorium undermines U.S. leadership and hands all adversaries a dangerous opportunity to get ahead. China is seizing this moment to advance in the Indo-Pacific. This is why I joined with my colleague Darren LaHood to introduce the U.S. Trade Leadership in the Indo-Pacific and China Act. Our bill will require President Biden to act and report on a trade strategy in the Indo-Pacific and with China. Once again, Democrats didn't allow any bipartisan input in their legislation. There has been zero guidance by President Biden on a trade plan with China. Instead, we continue on a useless wait-and-see approach. The competition between the U.S. and China demands strong leadership. Democrats must wake up to this reality and take decisive action. I urge my colleagues to support our bill and to ensure America's lasting trade leadership.
West Virginia Republican Representative Carol Miller. The massive legislative package includes measures to address the global semiconductor chip shortage and strains on the U.S. supply chain, both of which have contributed to the recent spike in inflation. At the Pentagon, officials briefed reporters on the August 2021 bombing outside the Kabul airport that killed 13 U.S. service members. Here's CENTCOM Commander General Kenneth F. McKenzie.
I found the brief you're about to receive to be powerful and moving. The volume of evidence collected, the testimony of more than 100 people, the analysis of experts, the findings of fact, and the conclusions of the team based upon that evidence gives a compelling and truthful examination of the event. The investigation found that a single explosive device killed at least 170 Afghan civilians and 13 U.S. service members by explosively directing ball bearings through a packed crowd and into our men and women at Abbey Gate. The disturbing lethality of this device was confirmed by the 58 U.S. service members who were killed and wounded despite the universal wear of body armor and helmets that did stop ball bearings that impacted them but could not prevent catastrophic injuries to areas not covered. The investigation found no definitive proof that anyone was ever hit or killed by gunfire, either U.S. or Afghan. This conclusion was based upon the careful consideration of sworn testimony of more than 100 witnesses, and especially those witnesses in observation towers, both American and British, who were in locations unaffected by the blast and that had commanding views of the scene before, during, and after the explosive attack. This conclusion was also confirmed by the findings and analysis of medical examiners and explosive experts, a review of all available physical evidence, and a review of all available video evidence, including an MQ-9 unmanned aerial vehicle, which began observing the scene about 3 minutes after the attack. At this point, I want to acknowledge that the investigation differs from what we initially believed on the day of the attack. At the time, the best information we had in the immediate aftermath of the attack indicated that it was a complex attack by both a suicide bomber and ISIS-K gunman. We now know that the explosively fired ball bearings caused wounds that looked like gunshots, and when combined with a small number of warning shots, that led many to assume that a complex attack had occurred. The fact that this investigation has contradicted our first impression demonstrates to me that the team went into this investigation with an open mind in search of the truth. It also confirms the age-old fact that the battlefield is a confusing and contradictory place, and it gets more confusing the closer you are to the actual action.
From the Pentagon briefing room, CENTCOM Commander General Kenneth F. McKenzie. President Biden signed an executive order aimed at strengthening union jobs in construction by expanding the federal government's use of collective bargaining agreements between unions and contractors on construction sites. He made these remarks at the Ironworkers Local 5, located in Upper Marlboro, Maryland. The president has promised that the bipartisan infrastructure law, which he signed in November to provide funding in part for construction jobs, would create good union jobs. And speaking of unions, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi told reporters she supports staffers who want to unionize.
Do you support staffer attempts to unionize here in Congress?
Well, we're just unionized at the DCCC, and I supported that. Yeah, I supported that.
Well, this statement on Capitol Hill to reporters on Thursday in an Instagram account that might have given new energy to the efforts to unionize. The headline at Politico.com, ground up and spit out. Inside the Hill staffer Instagram rebellion, Catherine Tully McManus, congressional reporter and author of the Huddle newsletter, one of a team of reporters who wrote this article that reads in part, "The Capitol's often overworked, underpaid, and mistreated workforce is riveted to the unfiltered stories shared by Dear White staffers." Catherine Tully McManus, what is going on here?
Well, it has been a poorly kept secret within Washington for years and years that pay on Capitol Hill is very low, that the workforce is very white, and that members of Congress and their staff rarely get management training and rarely have official checks on their behavior, which can lead to sometimes really toxic work environments and, frankly, folks not being able to pay their bills, and which can sometimes lead to staff on Capitol Hill looking not so much like the country, but more like who can afford to have family support to help pay the rent or pay for groceries and things like that when there's just not enough money coming in via a paycheck for those expenses. There's this Instagram account that started back in 2020, really, that was airing funny, but also very serious memes about life as people of color working on Capitol Hill and working with this majority white workforce, whether it was microaggressions they were experiencing or being able to look at another person of color in a very white room and kind of have that connection to know that they're in the same boat, that they have each other's back. But it has taken a very different turn in recent weeks. They have started posting anonymous submissions of personal experiences that people have had on Capitol Hill, some currently on Capitol Hill, some people 10, 15 years ago. What salaries they were making, what their bosses had them doing, what chiefs of staff said to them, what people asked about what they were wearing or made sexual advances. This is all anonymous is an important element here. And part of why we pursued this story was to talk about how this has become such a talking point and a must read for staff on Capitol Hill, but also to dig in, talk to some people who have made their submissions to verify and fact check some of the things that are going up there.
As you've been talking to people anonymously and on the record, what do you think they hope to achieve with these posts?
I think one thing that really unifies the posts is that there are misconceptions about what life on Capitol Hill looks like. Photographs that go in the news, fictionalized television and movies about politics in D.C., of course, feature gilded rooms, beautiful meals and receptions, and wining and dining and high-power lobbying situations, where in reality, when a constituent calls a lawmaker's office, there is usually a very low-paid young person from their community picking up that phone who might after work go to bartend, go to waitress, go to work at a retail store in order to pay for their electricity, pay for their rent in one of the most expensive cities in the country.
One part of the article that I read said, when I first went from intern to staffer, I made 25 grand a year. And I was working for a boss that was anti-subsidies, and I was having to live off food stamps and free health care because I could not afford anything else. Catherine Tully McManus, congressional reporter at Politico.com. With these stories and posts, can we expect investigations or any movement toward changing the work environment for these young staffers?
Yes. An important note about that quote that you just referenced, that was not an anonymous post. That was congressional testimony from a former staffer who went on to found an organization to help support
interns and young staff on Capitol Hill financially and through mentorship and things. So that is, you know, on the record, not just with a journalist, but on behalf of a committee on Capitol Hill. In terms of action, I can tell you that there is a push starting, frankly, this week to unionize staffers on Capitol Hill. Speaker Nancy Pelosi came out in support of what she said any effort for congressional staff to organize and exercise their right to collectively bargain. That is a huge move to have the Speaker of the House behind that effort. Today, staff came out with an organization and have already made a request to Congressman Levin to introduce legislation that is needed to clear the way for a unionizing effort. And he says, Congressman Levin says he will be acting on that as soon as next week. This has been basically waiting in the wings since 1996, is the last time anyone touched this unionization issue on Capitol Hill. And we're talking, you know, a quarter century has gone by. Staff on Capitol Hill were not alive the last time this was really in the ether on Capitol Hill. And that is a huge move. I do not know what the future holds for that unionizing effort, but the other path forward is, frankly, the committee to modernize Congress in the House, the Select Committee, has been working on so many of these issues, from diversity to staff pay to professional development and management training. They have made recommendations, over 100 recommendations, I believe, to the institution itself of how to not just improve the lives of staffers, but improve service to constituents, improve the legislative process, so that there's fewer roadblocks to bipartisanship and to actually getting things done, both for the nation legislatively and for constituents who are reaching out for help on personal issues in the community.
Now, we've heard from two House Democrats about this issue. What are we hearing from Republicans?
There was an outpouring of support on social media from a wide variety of Democrats after the speaker spoke up. On the Republican side, I have yet to see a response to this, but what we do have on the record are Republicans who have opposed over and over again broader legislative pushes to ease unionization efforts across the country for workers in all different types of workplaces. There is general opposition to unionization within the Republican Party. As for this specific effort, I think some Republican staffers might be in a tough situation if they are in a bad work situation in their own workplace, but either their personal politics or the politics of their member dictate a hesitancy towards unionization. They might have to choose between their workplace reality and their political stance.
Catherine Tully McManus, congressional reporter and author of The Huddle Newsletter. Find her article at politico.com. Thank you so much for helping us understand this issue.
Thank you.
A reminder that all of our coverage is online anytime at cspan.org. And if you missed any of this program, you can find it at cspan.org/podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. Also, if you'd like more on the stories that are shaping Washington, delivered daily right to your inbox, you can subscribe to C-SPAN's evening newsletter, word for word. Just go to cspan.org/connect to subscribe. I'm Nkoyo Iyamba. Thanks for listening today to Washington Today.